Following are final reflections on Shakespeare's King Richard II. Richard is at times a villain, especially early in the play, but he is also a reflective and poetical villain. Students of the play should probably, therefore, consider the extent to which the observations and moral sententiae, or summings up he repeats with gathering pathos, redeem him as a man with tragic insight into the nature of kingship. Does such language simply flow from and amount to self-pity? Another question concerns the element of tragedy in Richard II. The play is Henry IV's triumph, but it is Richard's tragedy. The question of tragedy in relation to Christianity is a complex one, since there's no question of positing a merely chaotic, senseless universe. Richard's fall was avoidable, in that it wasn't simply fated, i.e. in the sense of there being some external power that had decreed it would be so, but was instead due to his rapacious disregard for feudal loyalties, prerogatives, and common decency. Shakespeare doesn't follow any unitary model of tragedy. He builds his tragic intensities and ideals circumstantially, from one set of dramatic materials to the next. In this way, he is able to bring out whatever makes excellent drama in his source material. A notion of tragedy as broad as a fall from good fortune to bad, as in the De Cassibus tradition, serves a playwright of his astonishing caliber as a sufficient point of departure, while in a lesser author it might result in insipidity. One possibility to consider, aside from political philosophy, perhaps the play may be read as an argument between a vision centered on ceremony, the sacred, and the aesthetic dimension of experience. A Catholic vision, if we don't mind the proleptic reference, and a mindset that tends strongly towards clarity and the practical consideration of how to get and hold power. That would be Bolingbroke's proto-Machiavellian approach, for contrast. And we might also note in Henry the existence of a practical, iconoclastic, proto-Protestant sensibility. Tragedy, if we follow the Hegelian interpretation of that genre, must wrestle with competing sets of rights, as when Antigone, in the Sophocles play by that name, battles King Creon of Thebes over the granting of proper burial rites for her slain brother. Both have a kind of right on their side. In the current play, it may be that we are to dismiss neither Richard's aesthetic and ceremonial sensibilities, nor Henry Bolingbroke's businesslike understanding of power's imperatives. Wouldn't the perfect prince be the one who combines both? Bolingbroke is hardly liberated by his assumption of power from the sort of questions that nag at the deposed Richard. Indeed, he will return to just such questions from the moment he learns that his death wish against Richard has been overheard and carried out. The blood on Bolingbroke's hands turns out to be as durable as the quote-unquote anointed balm that in Act 3, Scene 2, King Richard had claimed could never be washed from a monarch's sacred body, even by all the water in quote-unquote the rough, rude sea. Richard II is deeply flawed, but we cannot easily dismiss him. The Richard who suffers and dies at the play's end can't be facilely reduced to the sum of the acts that brought him to his sorrow. Richard II is partly about a gruff, ugly transfer of power, but King Richard, by his own qualities and intelligence, himself calls upon us to consider the value of an essentially poetical, philosophical way of seeing and being that stretches beyond the troubled circumstances of his own life and reign. In the end, he proves more valuable as a philosopher than as a king. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Saturday, October 11th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume genre-based format.